Folks, I am really excited to talk about our newest sponsor for the coaching staff, Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust, also All-American Used Cars and Trucks. Two really, really good businesses. I'm going to start with Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust. You know, it's hard to find a good mechanic. It's hard to find somebody that you trust. And, you know, long before this situation came about, we had been taking our cars to Ruiz for a year, year and a half, and they've done great, great work. They're honest. They're upfront. They can do everything. They, you know, take care of your motor, take care of your brakes, tires, oil, so simple stuff like oil changes, brake pads, mufflers, whatever you may need. Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust are going to take care of it for you. If you are in the Omaha area and you are looking for a quality, reasonably priced, customer-friendly situation, you're not going to regret giving Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust a chance here. They are located at 4839 North 90th Street, Omaha, Nebraska, 68134. You could give Esmeralda a call up there. Her number is 402-317-2572. And they'll get you taken care of. I'm saying this as a customer. We literally do not bring our cars anywhere other than Ruiz Auto Service and Exhaust for anything that we do from this point for the last year or two. So again, another business here, All American Used Cars or Trucks. If you're in the market for a used car or truck, go check out Juan Carlos's business there. 144th and I-80, 14706 Schooner Road here in Omaha. Go check it out here. If you're looking to exchange a car, buy, sell, trade, whatever it may be, you're going to get an honest deal from honest people. So go check out Ruiz Auto Service and Exhaust and All American Used Cars and Trucks. Good afternoon, good evening. My name is Marty Plum, and I am your host of a Pen and a Napkin podcast, a weekly coaching clinic you can carry around with you in your pocket. Welcome back to the coaching staff, sponsored by Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust and All American Used Cars and Trucks. It is Mr. Tony D. Viss on the other end of the line here. Tony, it's cold. It's cold. It's no fun. I don't like this.
I'm in that same boat. You know, I think I shared with you that I try to do 10,000 steps a day. And there's been some mornings the past few. I'm might need to go have my sanity tested to see, because I cannot believe I'm still trying to get 10,000 steps in with this temperature. But yes, winter has arrived, and we were spoiled with the fall and summer sticking around maybe a little bit longer than what they usually do.
Yeah, it was kind of like summer, 2.5 weeks of fall, and here you go. It's cold. You know,
yes.
But we will survive, my friend. We will survive. And we are here with episode 110. We are going to talk about late game situations and late game prep, things that you should be thinking about as you're going through your preseason. You know, a lot of state associations are playing. Obviously, if you're a college coach listening, you're playing. You've played a lot of games already. But before we get to that, famous number 10s here, Tony, a lot of European footballers with the uniform number 10 here. Pele, Diego Maradona, Lionel Messi, Zinedine Zidane. And then we got a couple of, footballers, Eli Manning, Tyreek Hill, a couple baseballers, Chipper Jones, and a guy that's near and dear to my heart, Mr. Ron Santo, former third baseman for my beloved Chicago Cubs. I really was only able to find, I was surprised, Tony, two players that wore number 10 for their basketball career that I thought were worthy of us mentioning and talking about. One is retired from playing, and one is still active.
I'm going to be honest with you. 10 is not that popular of a basketball number, obviously. But I'm surprised that there's not a few more. If I were to guess one, and I don't know if this is right or not, so we'll just throw it out there, see if it sticks. Tiny Archibald.
It was not.
It was not.
No. Well, he had number 10, but I always associated him with number 1 more than number 10. So.
Okay. How about Isaiah Thomas?
He's number 11. So hold that for
oh, next week. I'm going to write that down here. Put it on a sticky.
Yeah. The retired player, former point guard like Isaiah.
Okay. Retired point guard like Isaiah. Tim Hardaway.
Good guess.
But not correct.
Whereas he should know. Didn't he wear number 10?
I thought so, but obviously I kind of try to pull rabbits out of the hat all the time. So I don't know on that one.
He wore number 10, uniform number. I feel bad. Yes, Tim Hardaway should have been on this list.
Okay.
Yeah. That's yeah. I'm sorry. They didn't list him on the website that I usually use for that. So
okay.
He wore 5, 10, and 14. So yeah, it should have been Tim Hardaway. That's my fault. Completely my bad.
So we're looking for another retired number 10.
Yes. Current announcer. He's also an announcer for his franchise that he played with.
Walt Frazier?
There it is. Walt Clyde Frazier is one. Okay. Current player, most noted for his time with the Toronto Raptors.
DeMar DeRozan.
Yes, and it counts. Borrowing from the New York Knickerbockers. Mark Albert. We're tied it all together. Yes. It is DeMar DeRozan. So you got it, buddy. You got it. And
speaking of Marv Albert, what a handoff going from him to Mike Breen for the Knicks. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, yeah. They did all right. They've done okay in that regard. They've been able to scout talent effectively. How about that?
I like it. I like it. Now if they could just do a little bit better with the team, but they're all right. I mean, the Knicks are back up there.
Yeah, they're starting to play better. They're starting to play better, starting to coalesce a little bit. And we're going to start talking about coalescing here as well. And we are going to jump into late game situations. Of course, you know, the higher up you go, if you're coaching sixth grade, seventh grade ball, you're not really working on late game situations. But if you're a varsity coach, if you're a college coach, these are things that you need to think about before they happen. And Tony and I thought it would be good to go through a lot of this stuff, you know, things that you should be preparing for, late game situations, common late game situations that you should be preparing for. I know, Tony, that for me, it was something that we were very detailed with. As a high school coach, sometimes we only had so much time to go through everything that we would want to go through. But throughout, you know, by, you know, at the very latest, probably by mid-December, we had covered all of these situations in practice. You know, sometimes we didn't have everything ready for the first game, but, you know, we got there eventually. Within the first month or so of practice, we had at least discussed, tried to walk through a couple of things with this. I don't know how how do you handle that, Tony, with your teams? How does Coach McCowan handle it with the Cougars? And you know, how do you guys do it there at Kennedy?
You know, late game situations is something that's near and dear to my heart. It's something that I put a lot of time into, but kind of like what you're talking about, Marty, that first 4 to 6 weeks of this week of the season, holy cow. I mean, you're just inundated with trying to get stuff in. And after, you know, you start to play some games and you run across these situations, it's like, we got to prioritize these in practice. And so, like I said, whether it's 4 to 6 weeks in, we begin to work on them and are very, very specific. And then another thing that we also try to do is when we get into the month of June, we just try to play a lot. And then if we transition into July, we've lost as much as we're playing. Like we're playing multiple games each week in June. In July, we don't have nearly as much stuff going on. And so I host a late game situation tournament with some area teams here in July. And just something that I put a lot of time in, because it's a deal where, you know, do you want to teach them how to run plays or how to play. And I think it's very important that you teach them how to play. And a big part of that is time and score. That's something that I see a lot with our guys is time and score, time and score. And, you know, once you throw the shot clock in there, you've got even more things to think about. And so we'll get in, like I said, 4 to 6 weeks, and then it becomes something when we practice that we work on every day, multiple scenarios every day. We might do like a quick 4 minute scrimmage here, 4 minutes later on, 4 minutes in a third spot, but we're going through these things. Up three, other team's ball, minute and a half left, here we go. Down one, 35 seconds left, our ball on the sideline, you know, and just working our way through that. I just think that's so very, very important to go over so that your guys have an idea of how you want to handle these.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of people think, well, you got to go through all of these different things. You have it well planned out. You know, you can just do something within the middle of your scrimmage. Hey, ball's on the side here. Blue team, you're down one, you got to score, you got one possession to score here, or different things like that. You know, I mean, there's a lot of different ways that you can go about this, you know, and it doesn't have to be completely, you know, tremendously organized from start to finish, but you have to prepare your team to do those type of things. It's just finding that, and again, it comes with being more seasoned and experienced. The younger you are, the more you have to kind of formally plan it out. The more seasoned experience you are, the more you can, I don't want to say wing it, might not be the right word, but you could kind of make those things up a little bit more on the fly and realize this is what we need to work on, you know, as we go through the season.
Yes. And, you know, one of the things that we'll do as well is we'll say, okay, you know, green team, you're up one, other team has the ball, it's on the side, 15 seconds left. You got to get a stop. What's your best defense? And then, you know, you kind of talk them through that, and then you run the scenario. We'll do another one where, you know, 15 seconds left, you have two team fouls. So we'll foul them two times to get to 14 fouls. Let them know, hey, can't foul the fifth time because that's two free throws here. But in those times that we fouled them, we might be in this defense. And then as they get ready to inbound it that third time, we switch to a different defense to try to catch them in the middle of running a zone play against a man defense or vice versa. And so you do some of those things as well to kind of mask and put some strategy in there with it as well so that, you know, it keeps practice. And I think the big thing that it does, Marty, is it keeps them mentally engaged. And it also helps practice from getting into a rut where we're scrimmage for 10 minutes. Okay, that's fine. You got to do that. Don't get me wrong. But if all you ever do is scrimmage for 10 minutes, scrimmage for 10 minutes, scrimmage for 10 minutes, it kind of gets redundant. And now all of a sudden, you can break it up into these smaller things, working on specifics. And I really think that helps your guys hold focus, and it keeps the monotony from creeping into practice.
Yep. So I got a list here of, you know, seven or eight things that you should be practicing to get ready for in-game situations. The first one that I got here, and these are in no particular order, is what I called 12-8-4. What are we going to do when there's 12 seconds left in the quarter, and let's say the other team is shooting a free throw, we've got a possession. What are we going to do with 8 seconds left? What are we going to do with 4 seconds left? And that was the last thing we did before we every game day, or the day before a game, we would practice 12-8-4. That was how we left the gym before every game. That was the last thing that we worked on. And, you know, a lot of times they're like, why do we go through this? You know, after the 10th time you go through, it's like, yes, we know what we're doing. I know, but we're still going to do it, you know? And that's actually something I picked up from Coach Finley, where, okay, the other team's shooting a free throw. There's 12 seconds left on the clock. Automatic, we're running this. It's a, you know, it's just an automatic 12-8-4. We're running this, this, or this. And that helped us. That helped us. It helped us in situations. We knew exactly what we were going to do, when we were going to do it, who was going to be where for the most part. And we got it. You know, that was really, really important for us for our end of quarter, end of half, end of game execution.
Yeah, we do something similar. Where we will do like a situation where we want the last shot of the quarter. and say there's 20 seconds left. We want the last shot of the quarter. We're going to engage at 8 seconds. So we might start off in a, you know, a set where we do some dribble handoffs up top, just kind of like a three-man weave dribble handoff. Yeah. Then when we get to 8 seconds left, we hop into, you know, we call horns if it's yep. man. And then we have another set that we run, whether we're going to run gold opposite or gold two, we'll hop into that with 10 seconds left because it takes a little bit longer against the zone. But anyway, and then we do what we call 8-7-6. So if there's 6 to 8 seconds left in the game, we run what we call last second play. And that's where we have to go the full length of the court in that amount of time.
Yep.
And another one we'll do, we call 3-2-1. We run the set that we call home run. And we'll do it where there's two guys up, where there's one guy up defensively, and we have to throw the ball the full length of the court. It's kind of Valpo's play with
yep.
Bryce Drew, Homer ran. And then the other one that we'll do from time to time is if we don't have the look that we want, like the kid's not catching the top of the key, to be able to land, pivot, and get the shot off or spray it to one of the outside guys, we'll take a timeout. And then we'll run something from the sideline if we have that timeout left. Mm-hmm. And so we'll run what we have specifically in for that. But I like what you're talking about, Marty, because one of the things we visit with our guys on is we want to make this so you can do this. It just becomes routine. You know where people are. Like, we got to have something, some structure so that we can get a shot off in this situation, because if you don't practice it, like these are stressful situations that yep. you can lose your mind in.
Yep.
And if you don't practice it, you're going to end up in a panic situation and not put yourself in a position to be successful. What I tell our guys, you know, is we want to be in the lead so we don't have to do this. But yeah. if it's not going our way, we've got to have something that we know where people are. We want to rep it so much that muscle memory comes into play rather than a sense of panic.
Yep. Yep. What do you got on your list, buddy?
Yeah, we like I said, we run through a lot of different things with them. We've got one. Again, we're down 2 points. There's 6 seconds on the clock. You have to go the full length of the court. Like I said, we'll hop in the last minute, what we call last second play on that one.
Mm-hmm.
We have another one, you know, where we'll go in. There's 25 seconds left in the half, and we'll try to add some discipline and structure into it where 25 seconds left to go in the half. You've got to value the ball till we get to that 8-10 second mark and then get into horns and get organized. And we try to make it where our guards are kind of interchangeable so that it doesn't have to be this one player at the top receiving the horn screens up top. It can be any of those three, but the post guys know where to get to. And a lot of times we play four guards anyway. And so one of them has to be comfortable setting a screen or coming off a screen, depending upon what side of the floor they're on. And so we'll do that with them. And then that home run play, like, you know, kind of like I was talking about there, it just depends upon where people are. Are there two guys up? Are there one guy up? Is it a great throw that we can get a shot off on? Or do we need to call a timeout and go into a different set that we have? But those are our three big ones that we like to work on in those situations so that it just becomes memorization, rote memorization, muscle memory, not, hey, let me draw something up on the whiteboard here real quick.
Yep. Yep.
As we enter into this holiday season, coaches, you know what would make a great gift for you this year? It would be a copy of Kings of Their Court, the story of the 2020-2021 season here in Omaha, three ranked teams in the top 25 in the country. And you're going to hear the personal and professional stories of players like Hunter Salas and Chucky Hepburn, Frankie Fiddler, William Kyle, coaches like Tim Cannon, Josh Ludke, and Doug Woodard. Just a terrific, terrific story, a crazy time period in our country with quarantine, politics, George Floyd, and everything in between. Yours for only $19.99. Go to Amazon, go to books, look up Kings of Their Court, and order a copy of that today. It's going to be a great stocking stuffer for you, for somebody that you love. Tell your wife, tell your spouse, tell your kids, hey, I would love to have a copy of this book and have something to read here and to just read about a great basketball story. Kings of Their Court, available on Amazon.com today. A big one, and a lot of coaches talk about this, and this is probably one of the biggest things that are debated with coaches, is fouling up three.
you know, and that is, you know, your philosophy. I think the more seasoned and experienced I got, the more I was like, we're going to foul if we can. But that being said, I think you have to, that's one of those you have to have gone over before you do it. I, you know, like I made the mistake 1 year of, hey, let's, you know, there was 12 seconds left. We were up two, or, you know, we were up three, and we went back into half court. I'm like, you know, or kind of like a three quarter court. I'm like, okay, foul when they, you know, get it here. And we hadn't worked on it, and they kind of rolled it up. And long story short, they burnt like 1 second and we fouled at half court. I'm like, no, that's not what I meant, but it wasn't their fault because I did such a crappy job of explaining it. And so I think that if you're going to foul up three, I think you have to spend time working on it. That's something that you really need to have structured and organized for 7 to 10 minutes in some, at some point during your practices to explain it. This is why we're doing it. Do it a couple of times, work on the free throw box out, know when you want to foul, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes. And one of the things I think as a coach that we have to keep in mind is that when you work on these scenarios, and there's a million of them, and it's one of those things where I don't know if you necessarily can cover everything, so to speak, but you can't get mad at them. And this is, you know, advice to myself as much as anybody, but you can't get mad at them if you haven't practiced it.
Yep.
You know, and you want to practice everything. I know we've talked about practicing where you want people to be in a timeout. I know we've talked about a variety of things, but this is more important in my mind than even, you know, some of these other things like practice taking a halftime break. That was one of the things I think John does an amazing job of is, you know, as we get to the state tournament, you have these longer TV timeouts built in. Yeah. And so we practice those things going into state tournament preparation. And this is one of those things as well that you want to make sure that you're doing, that you are going through, hey, if we're going to foul here up three with less than 10 seconds left, this is how we got to do it. Like, you can't foul them as they're getting ready to shoot the ball.
Yep.
And we want to try to zigzag with them as much as we can to get them to turn and change direction and waste time and then eventually get that foul. But yeah, I mean, it's things that you have to practice consistently with them so that when you're in those situations, the strategy that's there puts you in the best possible position to win.
Mm-hmm. What else you got, buddy?
You know, another one that I think that's big, and I kind of alluded to this a little bit earlier, is the fact that the shot clock, because the shot clock really does add some new wrinkles in there. And John and I, 1 year, talked about the fact that a lot of the NBA teams that make the playoffs are the teams that are the most efficient 2-for-1. Mm-hmm. And so when we get down to those, say there's 45 seconds left to go in the quarter or whatever, and we want to try to get a 2-for-1. And so we might run a last second play to get a shot up in 6-8 seconds and then try to play really good defense to get that second and that last possession of the quarter. So you can steal some of those things doing that as well. And so I think that's another thing that in this age of the shot clock that is also maybe under practiced and underappreciated is to try to sneak in those 2-for-1s.
Yeah, I had written down delay game, but then slash what set are we going to run? So, you know, you're up 4 with a minute 20 left and you're running the 35 second shot clock. And for whatever reason, the other team chooses not to foul. So, okay. You know, how much time are we going to run off? How are we going to do that? What set are we going to jump in? How do we finish off of that? You know, different things like that. That's something that I had written down as well, because like you're right, Tony, the shot clock has changed that end of game situation. You know, you're not, and it's for the positive, by the way, the game, you can't make a 32 minute game or a 40 minute game, a 26 or 28 minute game, and then run out the clock the last 4 to 6 minutes anymore. You got to keep playing. You got to keep earning that. And so, but what are you going to run in those situations? I think it's important. On the flip side of that, I had down, you know, when you're down, let's say you're down 4 with a minute and a half left and you choose to foul. okay? Or you're down four and there's 20 seconds left. You know, how to foul and whom to foul. You know, hey, we need to talk about this. We don't want Tony to get the ball. We've got to bracket Tony here. He doesn't get it. If it goes to Billy, that's when we want to foul. Here's how you foul. Here's how not to get an intentional foul. You know, all of those different type of things there when it comes to fouling, I think that's part of your educational process with your team and explaining to them, this is who we want to foul. This is who, you know, we want to take away. If we want to take away a certain somebody, this is how we're going to do it. You know, on down the line with that type of stuff. So I think that's another one that you need to cover.
Yes, and I think that's been done going in. So, like, you know, you've done your scout, you know, and sophomore basketball is a little bit harder to get stats and stuff like that, but varsity stuff on bound, different things like that, you have the other team's shooting percentages right in front of you. And so, like you're talking about, Marty, that's something that's built into your scouting report. Hey, you know, Tony is a 50% free throw shooter. We want to make sure that we get him. This is the guy we want to kind of leave open. And then once it comes there, make sure we get him right away. And that's another thing I think that's important to talk about as well, is the fact that, you know, if there's 10 seconds left to go in the game, you're down by either two or three. Are you fouling right away? Are you going to try to get into a hard trap and see if you can get a steal with a pass out of it? That's something else that you're going to want to make sure that you visit with them about as well. And then the other thing that you take a look at, if you're up two or three late, you know, are you putting somebody on the ball if they have to go the full length of the court? You know, I think that's one of the things from the Duke-Kentucky game back in the lore of basketball history that if Rick Pitino had to do it over again, I'm pretty sure he would put somebody on the ball. But those are things you need to think about so that you're not doing this on the fly. And so those are other things to keep in mind there as well.
What's another one on your list?
You know, another one that I would go with as well is the fact that, you know, if you get scored on with, say, 10 seconds or less, are you going to call a timeout?
Yes.
Because one of the things that I think you see a lot of times is the fact that you call a timeout right away, and then the guy over there with the dry erase board, he's got you coming against something that maybe you haven't seen yet. So previously, maybe you were seeing man-to-man the entire time. And now coming out of that, you've drawn up the look that you think you're going to get. And all of a sudden, they're in a 1-3-1, three-quarter court trap. It's like, oh, crap.
Yeah.
And so that's something to kind of keep in mind, too. Are you going to let it play out, or are you going to call a timeout? And, you know, with high school basketball and college basketball, we don't have what the NBA has in terms of taking that timeout and then advancing the ball to half court. So that's another thing that you have to keep in mind there as well. How are you going to get it there? How many timeouts do you have left? And those are things that I think that are important to discuss with your guys. You know, what's our set here? Like, hey, we've got to score. What is the set that we have the most confidence in that we're going to be able to score here? And then you have to go over as well, are you down two or are you down three? If you're down two, are you going to take the first good look? If that happens to be a three, if you're down three, you better make sure that you take a three, because whether you lose by one or whether you lose by three, you still lose. And so you have to have those sets built in to get you the looks that you want to get, whether it's, you know, Brad Stevens' famous winner or whatever the case may be.
Yep. I love that idea. I love that concept. And again, I think that's really important, you know, and again, it's team dependent. If you feel like you've got two or three people that can make a play, in that 8-9 seconds, you know, with the 10 seconds left, you know, then let it rip. I prefer playing through it, but every team is different, you know, and you got to judge your teams as you go through it. I think it's important to talk about shot quality. Kind of what you had talked a little bit about it earlier, Tony. You know, we, you know, I never got a chance to coach with the shot clock. But you know, we would talk about two different, you know, basically three different levels of the game, you know, just playing, you know, we're just playing. But then, you know, we had a little segment of the game, you know, depending on situation and score. But let's say we were up 12 with 6 minutes left to go in the game. We would say, okay, hey, look, we still want to stay aggressive, but we're in what we called golden nugget. We want to make sure that we take a really good shot. We're still looking to score. We're still looking to be aggressive, but let's be really conscientious about the shots that we're taking here. So we're in golden nugget time. So even with the shot clock, you can say, you know, if you're up 12 with 6 minutes left to go and you're coming out of timeout, hey, we're in golden nugget time. You know, we're in no hurry to fire up a contested three, you know, with 25 seconds left on the shot clock. Let's move it around, and let's look to burn some time while also getting a quality shot off, but we're also still looking to score. And then when we were in, you know, when it was really time to win, we felt like we had the game. If we just take care of the ball and make free throws, we just called it victory. And that was, we're only shooting uncontested layups, or we're getting fouled, we're going to the free throw line. Those were the only two shots that were allowed in victory mode. And, so I think you could still talk about that shot quality, maybe not so much the victory mode anymore, but definitely that golden nugget is something you can throw in there in a fourth quarter type of situation where, hey, we're still looking to score, but we want it to be a really, really quality look as often as we can make it.
Yeah, because you have a shot clock, doesn't mean that you can't run a little bit of clock. I mean, you can, you know, do some weave stuff, like you say, you know, just get spacing and spread out, whatever. And the other thing too, a rule change here in Iowa is the closely guarded with your dribble for five count is now gone. And so that's something that you also need to make sure that you're practicing with your team as well. But you can run 25 seconds off the clock and then get something up. But, you know, it's a deal where you can still be patient with the shot clock, but it does allow you to not turn it into a free throw game, you know, the last 4 or 5 minutes of the game. And I think that's one of the biggest things with the shot clock that's been helpful, is you can still play basketball and there's still a flow to it. And you don't have to turn it into a free throw contest with 5-6 minutes to go.
Yep. Yep. What else you got, buddy?
Yeah, another one that I will go with, and I think just kind of get ready to wrap up what I have here on my list, but another one too is the fact that with the shot clock, you know, we will run like a quick hitter, and that quick hitter flows into kind of a continuity out of it a little bit too, where you read and play off each other and you keep your spacing and stuff like that. But the other thing too is you can practice when you get down to 8-10 seconds left on the shot clock, you can have something you go to. And so maybe your bench is engaged with you. Maybe it's on your end of the floor where they start 10 and then they know, hey, when we get to that 10 second, if we don't have anything, these are the sets that we're going to as we play those last 10 seconds out. And so that's another thing that you can do that will help you work on some of those situations. I know it's not necessarily a late game situation, yeah, but it is a game situation in there where, hey, we've run, you know, if you have a 35 second shot clock, we've run 25 seconds off. We got to get a shot up here real quick. And for whatever reason, we're not getting a whole lot of continuity here. So let's go ahead. Let's flow into, you know, whether it's a box set, whether it's a ball screen or whatever it may be, but let's flow into this so we can get something up and we can get an attempt and not take a shot clock violation.
Yep. Yep. One of the things I like to have in my hip pocket, Tony, was one or two late game press breaks. Again, that situation, you're up five with 12 seconds left and the other team hits a couple free throws and now there's substitutions and you're doing all that stuff that you do at the end of the game, right? Okay, what's a press break? What's a designated, very conservative press break that we know we're going to get the ball inbounds, and if we do our jobs, they should have to foul us and we should be in good shape. And so one or two press breaks that, hey, we're only using this in the last 30 seconds or a minute of a game, guys and gals, This is going to be our go-to here when we just need to control the game and kind of finish it off here and just take care of the ball. So I think it's important that you have that in play as well.
We do something similar with that, but what we do, Marty, instead of having like a unique press break that we don't run a lot, what we might do is out of a press break, hey, Johnny's our best free throw shooter. And so what's going to happen in our three wide press break here, you two guys are going to set a double stagger. We're running Johnny this way and we're going to get the ball into Johnny and then we're going to, you know, give him some options to pass it to, but they're going to foul right away. We want to make sure that Johnny's the one that goes to the free throw line. And it could also be too that, hey, out of our press break, I know normally we have so-and-so inbound here on this one. We want it to be Susie because Susie's really good at getting the ball inbounds and keep their poise and knows, hey, if I get to 1,003, 1,004 in my head, they'll be able to get me a timeout so that we don't get a five-second violation. Mm-hmm. And so we might, you know, within the framework of what we already do, have a deal where, you know, and we where you get it to the person you want to get it, and you make sure that you have the inbounder that you want to be the inbounder. Mm-hmm. And so those might be a little bit of the caveats that we do with that. But one other one that we'll do as well, you know, it might be three team fouls. We're dribbling the ball up. They foul us. And now we got to take the ball on the side. And so in the other situations, we would run like side zone, side man, whatever the case may be. In this situation, I have one I call four in a row. And so we'll line up four in a row. And with that four in a row one, it's just to make sure that we have a better option of getting the ball in. So sometimes we will practice inbounding the ball on the side because I don't know if that's one that's always practiced a lot. And so we'll do that one on the side to make sure that we get the ball inbounded because I'd hate to see us get to that fourth team foul. We just need one more before we get to the bonus and we can't get the ball inbounds. And so we'll practice, go four in a row. This is where you're going. And these are the looks that we have.
Yep. I've got two more, Tony.
I am out, Marty. So okay. I'll let you fill these last two.
And this is more game by game situation, or this is in your huddles. One thing I was really conscientious of is, hey, I wanted to make sure that we were aware of how many timeouts that we had, and both for us and for our opponents. So a constant talking point during timeouts, during dead balls and close games was, how many timeouts do we have? And even, let's say, there's a dead ball. We say, hey, we've got three timeouts. And one of the things I would say, okay, how many timeouts do we have? And everybody, you know, we have three timeouts. Okay, good. And it's just a little 2 or 3 second thing, but that's important. And the kids knew it was coming. They got to the point where like, okay, we know he's going to ask. But we would do that. Let's say we do that. We go down, we shoot a free throw. They come down, they score again. They call timeout. We haven't burned a timeout. One of the first things we address in that timeout again is, hey, how many timeouts do we have? We got three, coach. Okay, good. All right. So, and we would just, okay, now we want to use our timeouts. If we get in any sort of pickle, make sure we're using that. I would go up to officials. Hey, if we get in a pickle here, we're going to be calling timeout, be listening for it, you know, just to give them a heads up, you know, type of a deal. That's one thing. And then the other thing that I had on my list, Tony, or anything on the timeouts?
Yeah. One of the things I've seen through the years, I've never done this myself, but one of the things I've seen through the years is coaches that are out of timeouts, they have like a baseball cap on the bench with them.
10 weeks.
And they will put the baseball cap on so that the teams know that they're out of a timeout and then they don't end up taking one and getting a technical foul.
Yeah. Jim Weeks here in Nebraska, famous for that. So the last thing is I always had on my game sheet, my play sheet, whatever you want to call it. I always had my free throw team written out, my ball handling team, my pressure team, my 3-point team. You know, we need to make free throws. Who do we want in the game? We need to handle the ball here. And a lot of times those two are linked together in a lot of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
But who's our pressure team? Who do we want to have in if we really want to attack the ball and really pressure it? And who's our 3-point team? Now, was that a hard and fast thing? Is that what we were going to do come hell or high water? No, it wasn't. But at least I had thought about it before the game, that there was something in front of me that I knew I had, that it was a point of reference. And, oh, hey, I got to get Izzy in there for Mary because we're down three with 20 seconds left. I want to get her in there. She's one of our best 3-point shooters. It just begins that process. For me, getting ready for the end of the game began the day before as I was putting together my play sheet for the opponent for the next day. So that had started my end of game prep started before practice had even started the day before, by thinking about who I wanted in at the end of the game in specific situations, different things like that. And so that is something that I had with me. And again, did I stick to that script? No. Probably, 50-50, but at least it was there just for something that I needed.
Yeah, and I think it's important to have it written out, like you said, because in the craziness of those moments, if you don't have it written out, you might only make a mistake on one of the players that you should have had in there, but it could be enough to cost you that game. So you want to have as much, like you said, prep done as possible. But the other thing too, in practice, you can be doing that stuff as well where, hey, we've got our defensive team in here and different things like that. Because you see teams all the time, whether it's college or pro or whatever, they practice that offense, defense, substitution thing. Hey, Jimmy's in right here. We're on defense. All right, Johnny, be ready to go, because if we flip to offense and we can get you in for him to be out there to knock down those free throws, we're going to do that in a heartbeat.
Yeah. And a lot of times kids think, well, you're taking me out for offense for free throw shooting. That must mean that I can't shoot. No, no, no. We're not saying that. It's just, this is where your strength is. This is where Billy's strength is. And I think it's important that you explain that either before or after, probably not during, but before or after the game. And you, again, talking about role definition, and I know we've talked about that extensively throughout the years with this, Tony, but having your kids understand this is why you're in, this is why you're not in. And of course, this goes back to a bigger thing. If you want to be in, if you don't want me to worry about me, being taken out of the game at the end of the game, then become an all-around player. But I think those are important conversations to have when it comes to roles. I think there's roles, and then there's roles at the end of the game. And oftentimes those are two different things, and you have to explain that as well.
Yes. There's the, I don't know if general is the right term I want to use, but there's the general role that you kind of see. And then as you get in the season, now you're allowed and able to have some of those more specific conversations. Hey, you're one of our best five defenders. At the end of the game, I got to have you on the floor. Hey, you shoot 83% from the free throw line. Got to have you in at the end of the game to knock down those free throws for us. And so I think, you just continue to have those conversations and go for more generalities into more specificity as the season progresses and you put yourself in positions to practice those late game situations.
Coaches, by now you have seen the newest thing coming out of a pen and a napkin, the Opening Tip Substack newsletter. I put an edition out there for free, and hopefully you see what a great investment this is going to be for you as a coach. I'm guessing it probably is, if you watch everything and listen to everything, it's going to take you almost 3 hours to get through everything on the Opening Tip newsletter here. What do we have in there? You've got an original article by myself here, just thoughts, ideas on different coaching topics. Into the Lab, that's probably my favorite thing, is the Into the Lab. It's me, another coach, and a whiteboard, and we're just drawing stuff up here. Stuff to help you out, to help you become better, and to help your team become better this coming season and beyond. Got another exclusive podcast. You heard the first one, Industriousness from the Wooden Pyramid of Success, and it's me and it's two semi-retired former girls basketball coaches, Matt Kern of York, Nebraska, Nate Wall of David City Aquinas here in Nebraska. And every newsletter, we're going to break down an aspect of Wooden's Pyramid of Success. Bookshelf recommendations from Off the Bookshelf, X's and O's stuff. I'm dropping in a university video. It's just going to be given to you there, and I really believe in the products that I've put together. It's practical stuff that's going to help make you a better coach. And then we've got the Coach's Corner with links to clips and articles. As you saw, we had our two Olympic coaches, Steve Kerr and Cheryl Reeve. Just really, really good stuff here. And I know it's subscription based, but goodness gracious sakes alive, as Coach Wooden would say, it is so affordable. $8 a month for two newsletters. That's $4 every newsletter. That's $2 every single week. Or you can get a year-long subscription, $75. That's 24 editions of the newsletter. That's basically $3 a newsletter. That's basically $1 an hour if it takes you about 3 hours to get through everything that you're getting here. It could not be more affordable. It could not be more positive for you. It's going to help make you a better coach. So
subscribe to the Opening Tip newsletter. Folks, you're not going to regret it. Well, Tony, you know who's always ready for every late game situation?
Europe.
Yes, they are prepared. They are ready to go. They always close solidly. And it is time for a little trivia. Mr. Viss, are you ready for this week's trivia question?
Let's try it.
All right. I don't know if you heard or not, but the University of Connecticut men's basketball team went 0-for out in Hawaii. I don't think if you had that on your bingo card, hats off to you, because I don't think anybody saw that coming. That UConn, you know, I think everybody thought they could definitely lose a game without a doubt, especially with the strength of the field out there. But to lose two in a row and then they lose three in a row, pretty significant. And it got me to thinking, Tony. I don't think anybody is necessarily thinking that this is going to happen, but UConn, of course, is the defending men's national basketball champion. The question is for you, Mr. Viss. Who was the last men's national champion to miss the NCAA tournament the next season?
That's a good question.
I will give you a hint. I will give you a hint because it has happened since 2010.
Okay. Let's just go North Carolina.
That is incorrect.
Okay. I'm going to stay in the state of North Carolina. Let's try Duke.
That, too, is incorrect.
On fire. Okay. Let's go with... Michigan.
Michigan is incorrect. The answer is the University of Connecticut.
And I was going to say that. They can't beat that.
No. And I didn't know that. I came up with that question and I'm like, I had to research it and figure out who it was. So I didn't do that on purpose per se.
Was it Kevin Ollie's crew?
It was Kevin Ollie's crew. They won it in 2014. I think that was Kemba Walker's year. And then the following season, they did not qualify for the tournament. And I think the next season after that, he got let go. And that's mm-hmm. when, I think that's when Dan Hurley came in right after that.
Yeah. I think Dan replaced him.
Yeah. So Kevin Ollie and the 2014-15 Connecticut Huskies are the last NCAA tournament champions or the last program to not qualify for the NCAA tournament from the year before. So kind of an interesting statistic, so much so that I would say...
How about that?
So... let's talk a little more UConn here, Tony. Not only did they lose the three games in a row, but obviously a lot was made of Coach Hurley and his sideline behavior, especially during the Memphis game. There's been some other situations. I know something happened here last year when they played at Creighton. That was actually the last game that they lost last year, was against Creighton. It was on social media somewhere where he got into it with a fan after the game, and obviously a fiery guy, but how much of that can kind of wear thin? You don't want to, you got to let the lion roar a little bit, but is this something that we should be addressing? Do we just let Dan Hurley be Dan Hurley? What do we do with it, buddy?
The one thing that's always interesting is when you have a lot of success, you're allowed a lot of rope. If Dan Hurley hadn't won the last two national championships, say they were 500 or got knocked out in the first round of the tournament, would the UConn admin be putting up with what they're putting up with? Mm-hmm. And the other thing that you have to balance in there as well, a lot of times the genius, if you will, it's borderline. Like it walks that fine line. And Dan is a great basketball coach. I mean, he's forgot more basketball than I will ever know. Yep. And, he is a brilliant coach. But the behavior is hugely concerning. And Marty, I also want to add this in Dan's defense as well. I watched the Memphis game. And did Dan have an issue? Oh, most definitely. I thought, and I'm not trying to be mean because I know officiating is really, really hard, but I thought that he was right on a lot of his complaints. I mean, to me, it seemed like the Memphis players, and again, what's actually going on, what it looks like on TV might be two different things, but it looked like they were flopping a lot. And it looked like the officials were giving into the flops and rewarding that, if you will.
Yeah.
And so Memphis shot over twice as many free throws as UConn did. Should Memphis have shot more free throws than UConn? Most definitely, because UConn was down. They fouled trying to get Memphis to the free throw line and have them miss some shots, so on and so forth. I get that, but not over two times as many. And then the foul call where they called the player for over the back, that I didn't agree with as well.
Yeah.
I thought it was two guys going for a rebound, kind of like a 50-50 ball, if you will. And I thought it was the wrong call. But here's the deal. Like, do I get frustrated with officials? Most definitely.
Yeah.
But in a tight game in overtime, to lose it like he lost it, and I'm not going to say on here what he said, but completely wrong, went way past the boundary, if you will. And if I were the Maui Classic, I don't know if I would invite UConn back again for a long, long time. And the crazy thing that Dan did, and I don't know if you caught his press conference, but you did something stupid. No doubt about it. You made a big mistake. But then he goes and doubles down on it.
Yeah.
And it was, I knew when I saw those two officials, it was going to be one of those games.
Yeah.
And I've never seen the other guy. I mean, it's like somebody should have clicked his mic. I don't know if the AD should have went in with him. I don't know if an assistant coach would have went in with him. But he can't do that. You can't double down on that type of behavior.
Yeah.
And so, yes, there should be some ramifications for this. Will there be? Probably not. And the other thing that I was talking about a colleague this week with it, could you imagine if Dan had got the Lakers job? You cannot coach like this for 82 games in a professional sports season. The NBA officials aren't going to put up with what he did in Maui. And the other thing I would throw at you as well is with a veteran professional team, they're eventually going to tune that out.
Yes. And I think he knows that. I think he knows he's a high school or college coach in that regard. I wholeheartedly agree with you. I think it is. I know this, Tony. When I got too worked up about the officiating, you know what kind of job I did as a coach? I did a crap job. I was terrible. Mm-hmm. Again, hard lessons learned throughout time. It was amazing when I just worried about my players and worried about the game, we seemed to play better. Doesn't mean we won every game. Obviously, we didn't, but it was better that way. I just think that, like you said, I think one of the great points that you made, Tony, is he doubled down on it. I think when you get that fixated on the officiating and you don't let that go, again, hard lesson learned by myself. You know what that allows your players to do? It allows your players to have excuses for why they lost or why they didn't play as well or they didn't win as much as they should have. And I think that you have to eliminate those common ways to kind of bail out of responsibility. And I think that Coach Hurley needs to do that. I think we are at a very dangerous point, not only with basketball at the collegiate level, but at the youth level, at the officials are getting harder and harder to find because they don't want to put themselves through those scenarios. We had a situation happen here at a youth tournament, and about a week or two ago where we had an official that got punched. It was a youth tournament. And I know who the official is. And I could have shared it, but I'm not going to glorify that stuff. I'm just not going to do that. I don't think people understand that if we don't have officials, we don't play. Uh-huh. We don't play. And if you alienate all the good officials, then you're just going to, I mean, you're just making it worse and worse and worse. And again, I have a soft spot for it because my dad was an official for a long time at the junior high and JV freshman level. You know, he did a few varsity games, but he didn't, you know, he chose to stay close to home for family reasons. And I just think it's a very dangerous precedent to set if this becomes the absolute normal thing. And I know we've seen it throughout the years with the Bobby Knights and the, you know, Rick Pitino would get on an official, John Thompson would get on an official, you know, and different things like that. But I just think we, you know, we're at a tipping point. And when somebody who is as brilliant as Danny Hurley is, and he's done such a great job at UConn, if these things start to overshadow his brilliance as what he does with his team and what he does on the floor, I hope that this is an isolated incident and it doesn't happen again.
And if I remember correctly, and you may want to fact check me on this one, I think he has tattooed on his wrist or his arm somewhere, "Coach your team." So, I mean, he's aware of it. And I think we all are. Like you're talking about, you know, if you get wrapped up in the officiating, if you get wrapped up, you know, in some other things, how as a coach, it can slide the wrong way. And so I 100% agree, you know, control what you can control. I've never seen, you know, someone screaming at an official, "Oh, my bad, I'm gonna change the call." You're right.
Yep.
I haven't seen that. And so just some food for thought.
Yep. Yep. Speaking of legendary coaches, Tony, heartbreaking yesterday to hear that Louis Carnesecca, the legendary St. John, where he's most noted for his St. John's days, passed away. Age 99. Obviously, he had lived a very fulfilling and long life. Brought me immediately back to my childhood, the Big East in the 1980s, watching that on ESPN, Big Monday on ESPN, USA Network. Louis Carnesecca was one of my, as a dorky kid in Iowa, I loved Louis Carnesecca. I loved the Big East. I lived and died with those games as much as I did the Big Eight and the Big Ten. Just a sad day in basketball history. Obviously, you know, Coach Carnesecca was 99 years old, so you know his time had come. The ugly sweaters, the great 85 team that he had at St. John's with Chris Mullen and Walter Berry and Bill Wennington, later on Mark Jackson, and was just a basketball icon without a doubt.
Yes. To be honest with you, Big Monday, Big East, if I were to sit here and grade, you know, in terms of what made me fall in love with basketball, that's probably the number one thing. Whether it was Louis Carnesecca's St. John's team, and you mentioned some of the great Hall of Fame type players they had. You then could jump and go with Jimmy Boeheim at Syracuse and John Thompson at Georgetown. And I mean, it was a must watch every Monday. Was Big Monday with the Big East. It was about as great a basketball conference as I can ever remember. And Lou, like you said, with the sweaters and stuff, you know, very iconic, his look and different things like that. And you know, it's no accident that after he retired, St. John's struggled for a long time.
Yeah.
And now with Rick Pitino being there, you hope that he can get it back up to where Lou did with the championships and the Final Four appearances and so on and so forth that happened there. But yes, Louis Carnesecca, what a great college basketball coach. And probably the biggest thing that I would give him, you know, for him, it wasn't just X and O's. He really, really established great relationships with his players.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just one of a kind, an icon without a doubt. College, you brought up a great point, Tony. College basketball is better when St. John's is really good. Now, they have some limitations. With, you know, like they have a small on-campus facility, but they play at Madison Square Garden as well. But they are a blue blood. Coach Carnesecca is a big reason for that. And like I said, just saw a little bit of my childhood kind of pass when that came across the Twitter sphere yesterday. So, you know, just a tough day for basketball and a tough day for college basketball, because I love college basketball. And we just wish our best to Coach Karnisek's family and the St. John's family. And, you know, rest in peace, Coach Karnisek.
Coaches, you know just as well as I do that we're always looking for new and different ways to motivate our players and programs. But sometimes it's hard to find that perfect source that we're looking for. Over the past 25 years, I've collected hundreds of handouts to help motivate my players and programs. And now I'd like to share some of my favorites with you. The A Pen and a Napkin 101 Best Handouts booklet is now available to you for only $15. In this booklet, you'll find motivational material for all types of situations and individuals to help you communicate your values to your players and program. For ordering information, you can either DM me on Twitter or email me at apenandanapkin@gmail.com for details. Coaches are absolutely loving our Taking Over a New Program booklet. As many of you know, I spent 2 years outside of coaching, and during that time, I hung a note card in my workspace at school that said, "Strip the house down to the studs." I took that time to really rethink and reorganize my thoughts on what it takes to run a transformational program. As I prepared for the possibility of coaching again, I organized these thoughts into this 96-page booklet. How much do I trust this booklet? I used this booklet as I went on interviews to help sell myself and my vision for what my new program would look like. If I'm using it to sell myself, why wouldn't I recommend it to you, my listeners? This booklet will help you look at any part of your program, no matter what stage you're at in your program, and help improve it in some way. It's all yours for only $15, which includes shipping and handling. For more information, email me at apenandanapkin@gmail.com. Tony, let's talk about a little Houston Rockets right now. They are one of the surprises of the NBA right now. They are number two in the Western Conference. They are 14-6. They are young. They are athletic. They are deep. Is this a fluke, or is this something that could be sustainable?
I think it's sustainable. And what I mean by it is I don't necessarily think they're going to finish in the top two in the West, but I think they are definitely a playoff team that's a threat to win a round, maybe two in the playoffs. But they've got some nice pieces. Like you said, they've got some experience. They have some youth. And probably the biggest thing they have is depth. And I think you touched on this a little bit over the past, Marty, is the fact that you have to have a couple things. One, you have to have a couple stars. And I think they have that. Mm-hmm. And then two, you have to have stars. Sorry, you have to have guys in roles that fill around those stars. I think you talked about the Nugget blueprint with Jokic and Murray. And then they had those pieces around them. Now, some of those pieces have left, unfortunately, and Murray's not playing at the level that he at one time was. But I think that's a big part of it, is they've got some stars. They've got some depth. And they play well together. But probably the biggest thing for Houston is they went out and they got an elite NBA coach, Ime Udoka. Yeah. And I think that's the thing that makes them such a threat is him. And so I can see Houston being like a 4 or 5 seed in the West, maybe as high as a 3. And I could see him winning a round and potentially 2 in the NBA playoffs.
Yeah, they are going to be a hard out. Because of their depth, their athleticism, their competitiveness. They're just a team. And again, that comes from Ime. You're going to have to play really, really hard against them in order to beat them. You know, they've had some high draft picks. They have hit on most of those. Jalen Green, you know, some people kind of think the jury is still out on him, but I think he's only like 21 years old. He's got some crawling mm-hmm. left to do. Shangoon is very, very talented. I like Jabari Smith as a role player. They've got more athletes like Amen Thompson Cam Whitmore, who doesn't get to see a lot of time with them. Tari Eason coming off the bench. Again, just long, athletic, creative, disruptive type of players. They've got 7 guys averaging in double figures, Tony. A lot of people believe that Reed Sheppard was going to be Rookie of the Year or would have a chance at Rookie of the Year. But Tony, he's played in every game, but he's only playing 12 minutes a game. He can't get into the rotation because mm-hmm. they're playing so well. And so I think this is a team. They're probably a little bit ahead of themselves. a little bit ahead of the schedule that they had set for themselves. But I think this team does have a chance. At the very least, they are going to be a really, really tough out in April just because of that length, that athleticism. They have some draft picks. They've got some older, you know, Fred Van Vliet is a steadying guy, a mature guy. Dylan Brooks. Not the most mature guy on the floor, but he's competitive, is all get out, and he's bringing that, you know, he's kind of got that Ime Udoka, we're going to be dogs out here, so to speak. As the saying goes, we're going to be dogs out here. And so he brings that intensity on a daily basis, and this team has a chance to do some good things.
I think, like you mentioned with Van Vliet and Brooks, you've got adults in the room with a really young team, and like you mentioned, kind of that junkyard dog mentality. Shanguin that you mentioned earlier, I think he might be their all-around best player. Like, he could develop into, you hate to compare anybody to Jokic, but he could develop into that Jokic type piece for them.
A pivot point to play off of, yes.
Yep. And then I could see them packaging, whether it's young players or draft picks, and going and getting another piece, which would make them even more dangerous come playoffs. Mm-hmm. But like you said, they are a little bit ahead of schedule. But I think Dylan Brooks, when he went there, said that this Houston team reminded him a lot right before Memphis became really good. It reminded him of his Memphis days. Mm-hmm.
Tony, who are you up on this week?
I'm going to go with the TCU Horned Frogs on the women's side for college. Yeah. I don't know if you watched this or heard this or not, but they knocked off Notre Dame, who had just beat a top team in USC. Sidonia Prince has never been able to be healthy. And guess what? She's been healthy this year. I think she had 20-20, mm-hmm. if I remember correctly, against Notre Dame. And then Haley Van Lith has been back to her old self, back from when she played really well at Louisville.
Yep.
And he's even taken it even up another notch with TCU. And then they have a third star, and I cannot recall her name right now, but that is who I'm riding with right now. I think they are a top five team in women's basketball.
They are playing really well. Madison Connor, I think, is who you're thinking of there for the kind of the third wheel of the tricycle here. Sidonia Prince, 20-11 and 4 blocks a game. Haley Van Lith, 7 assists a game, and averaging 20 points a game. Playing terrific ball. Another team from the college realm on the men's side that I want to bring up for who I'm up for this week is Auburn. People thought that they were going to be really good. I don't think that they thought they were going to be this good. They go into the city of Houston, not necessarily Houston's arena, but they beat Houston inside the city limits of Houston. We'll call at that, Tony. They win the Maui Classic, beating Iowa State and North Carolina, and then beating Memphis in the final convincingly after Memphis had, of course, knocked off Connecticut. They've got another big one this week, Wednesday night, at Duke. You know how much tickets are going for at Cameron for Tuesday night's game or Wednesday night's game, Tony?
Let's go 500.
You got to keep moving on up there, buddy. $678, according to StubHub.
That's about what you make an hour?
Yes, off this very podcast. That's about what I make every hour. Is that so? It should be a good one here. I really like them. They're a tough team. They're deep. They're, you know, Bruce Pearl, really good basketball coach, former Tom Davis assistant. Really, really good team this year. So. Who are you down on, or what are you down on this week, Tony?
I'm going to go with the Wizards, Marty. They've lost 14 straight games in the association, and just one of those deals where sometimes the NBA, depending upon your matchup or whatever, you can steal one. But they were they started off 2-2, yep. and are now 2-16. So I'm putting them on the group to sell.
Yeah, they are putting up the flag for flag. They are waving the white flag for Cooper flag. Looks like they're giving up about 125 points a game here during this streak. 129 to Atlanta, 124 to Detroit, 134 to the Knicks. They only gave up 108 to Boston, 127 to the Bulls, 121 to the Clippers, who are not offensively explosive. I guess we will use that term, but this is by design. They were going to be one of those teams that was probably going to tank to start the season out anyway. So not unforeseen, but this is pretty ugly basketball inside the Beltway for even for the Wizard standards. It's pretty ugly. How about that? So
yes.
I'm going to zig here a little bit, Tony. I wanted to talk about this, wanted to bring this up. I am really down. And this is a basketball podcast, and I firmly get that. But I am so tired, especially after this weekend, of the flag posting here in the middle of the college football stadiums. We had the brawl breakout with Ohio State and Michigan, North Carolina State and North Carolina, Florida, Florida State. I mean, Florida's losing their minds over beating a crappy Florida State team. You know, we... I'm going to get on, I maybe get on my soapbox a little bit. You win with class, you lose with class. You won the game, you know, Sarkisian would not allow his guys to do that at Texas A&M, the other night or last night, which was good to see. You know, rivalries are what makes college sports. But when we've got full-fledged brawls breaking out and police officers are forced to use mace and stupid stuff like that, I mean, you gotta have control of this as a coaching staff. You absolutely have to. I remember, when I was at Scott at one point, probably the best team I had when I was at Scott, and we played South Sioux City. After we had beaten them the year before, and they came into our place, and our kids were really juiced and ready to go. And I mean, we kicked the holy you-know-what out of them. I mean, we were up 30. And I remember, distinctly remember, calling a 20-second timeout with about 5.5 minutes left in the game. And I said, all right, here's the deal. We're going to win this game. Starters, you got about one more minute, and I'm going to take you out. We're going to play this out, and we're going to walk out of this gym like we expected this to happen. We're not going to celebrate. We're not going to freak out. We're not going to do any of this. We're going to save all that crap for the locker room. We can do whatever we want to in the locker room, but we're not going to embarrass somebody out here like this because we wouldn't want that to happen to us. And, you know, I think that's you know the tensions are going to be high. Coaching staff, you got 1,000 people on the sideline there to do all this other stuff. You know, the guys can't even drink their own water. They got to have somebody pour water into their mouth when they're on the sideline. Goodness gracious sakes alive, can't you keep some guys away from the middle of the field and acting stupid at the end of a game? I just think that there's no call for this. I'm off my soapbox. I'm done with it. But I'm really down on this stuff, Tony.
Yes, something needs to be done or you are going to see a lot of people turn away their eyes away from college sports and find something different to do, because that's not the behavior that we want young people to emulate. And I get, you know, rivalry games are more heated, emotions are high, but as a coach, you've got to do something. I mean, I hated to watch the footage yesterday of Ohio State and Michigan. And again, I'm not trying to just dump on Ryan Day, but as the head coach, you've got to do something. He just sat there and did not do anything. And that was a big part of why that escalated like it did. And then, like you mentioned, police got involved. And the next thing you know, we've got some pepper spray and different things like that. So, yes, things need to be put back in order.
Yeah. Tony, episode 110, late game situations. Anything for the good of the cause here to wrap it up?
You can't cover everything, but you got to make a priority list and you've got to get these things in your practice plan, because here's the deal. And like we mentioned this earlier, and I'm as guilty of it as anybody. You can't get on your kids if they don't execute in those spots, if you don't practice them.
Yes. And you live, you learn. If you get in that situation and you're not ready, what should be the first thing you do? In your next practice after that situation, you go over it. It's all about teaching. It's all about growing. You know, high school coaches, you have anywhere from 90 to 120 days to get your team ready for your postseason. And you got to learn from it and you got to get better from it. So I think that's what you emphasize. So Coaches, hope you've enjoyed this episode number 110, late game prep, situations you should prep for. We want to thank our sponsor, Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust, All American Used Cars and Trucks. Great discussion, Tony. Stay warm over in the Cedar Valley, my friend.
It's supposed to be in the 40s at some point this week, so I probably will go shirtless and shorts that day, but we'll see what happens.
That is a sight I do not want to see, even in the summertime. So, hope, coaches, you have enjoyed this episode 110, another good one. We'll have some more stuff to talk about next week. Coaches, as always, let's be sure to hone our craft one day